I gotta double check it. We'll send it out to him. That's exciting.
Jordan Howard, this week?
I think so.
Good evening, and welcome to the regularly scheduled September 1st meeting of the San Luis Coastal Unified School District Board of Trustees. The board met previously in closed session, and we conferred with our labor negotiators regarding areas of board interest with CSEA, Confidential Employees, Management Educators Council, San Luis Coastal Teachers Association, and Service Employees International Union, and was discussion only. Do we have consensus on the order of business? Okay, seeing that we do. Approval of the minutes.
I'll make a motion to approve the minutes for August 18th,
2009. Second.
Moved by Mr. Spadafor, seconded by Mr. Millar. Those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? That passes unanimously. And move on to reports. Originally, we had scheduled the first item under reports to be reports by school staff and administrators, not anticipating that we would have a student present. So we are delighted that we have our first student representative of the year from San Luis Obispo High School, and that would be Harley Bonilla.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey. I'm Harley. I'm a senior at SLO High. I'm in ASB. I'm our school's student congress chair. So I'll be here with you guys all year, and I'll be on management team at the school. So I'm really excited. So our school year, I feel like we've really hit the ground running. It seems like it's off to a great start. We started out with our annual back-to-school night, August 26th. Our Black and Gold Boosters hosted the pizza dinner like they do for us every year. It was great. Our gym was a lot more full than usual. We had a great attendance rate, and so it was great for all the parents and kids to go and be able to meet the teachers and get a taste of what the school year was going to be like. So I feel like that set a good pace for our school year so far. We had the senior parent college meeting beforehand for some guidance. Our ninth grade parent meeting, helpful for the freshmen. The next day, August 27th, we started school, which, despite the heat, we actually had more students in attendance than last year. Our enrollment rate has increased by about 40 students, so we have around 1,540 students attending this year. So that's good. So we're off to a great start, and we're hoping to continue that with our upcoming activities this month. We have, on the 17th, our first meeting of the Principal's Parent Advisory Council at 7 o'clock in the library so the parents can meet and talk with Mr. Jones. On the 18th, we have our Welcome Back Assembly, so we're going to have kind of like a fall sports rally, get everyone pumped up for the school year. ASB is working on that right now. And also the night of the 18th at 7:30, we have our first home football game against Oxnard, hoping to win. And at all of your chairs, there was a courtesy card to come to all of our home athletic events, so feel free to come support the Tigers. And the last main event so far for September is on the 30th. There's a UC application night at 7 p.m. in the cafeteria for senior parents. So that's going to be good for getting some help applying to the UC colleges this fall. And other than that, we're just working on some ongoing projects. ASB is planning homecoming right now. So just a lot of student activities going on, and we've started off great the school year so far. We're going to continue that.
Well, thank you very much for your report. Typically how this works is we're delighted to see you give your report, and then if there's anything on the agenda that interests you, you're always welcome to stay. Just keep your seat. You can chime in with whatever comments or concerns you might have, but if you don't have those, we're mindful that you have homework and other obligations, so you're welcome to leave and free to leave at any time with our thanks.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we look forward to seeing you the rest of this year.
Thank you.
Okay, then we'll go to item two, which was really one, reports by school staff and administrators. Seeing none, educational services update on the English Learners Program, Dr. Matakovich.
Yes, thank you, Madam President. Well, as our student representative said, we had a great opening of the school year. If you were able to attend some of the back-to-school meetings, you experienced the enthusiasm of our staffs. We're very properly staffed, thanks to our superintendent's calculations, even though our enrollment's up by 157 students for a grand total of 7,110 students. So good job, Ed. And we anticipate that by the 10th day, we should have our classes pretty much set. I want to thank our teachers and our administrators for the fine preparation that went into this opening week, and even with the hot weather, they made it wonderful for the students. On another topic, I'd like to thank Mr. Buckman, Dr. Eisendrath Rogers, and Mr. Spadafore for their assistance in planning the teen drug study session. You've given us your questions to be answered, and we have a representative group to come and discuss them with you. We look forward to that study session at the end of the month. You'll be getting a packet a couple weeks before the session so we all can come prepared. So thank you for your support in planning that session. Also, our countywide first preschool center for 3-year-olds and 4-year-olds is in progress right now at Smith School. We're integrating developing peers with disabilities, and it's off to a great start. We want to thank Sally Ames, the coordinator, teacher Patricia Nolan, and Principal Amy Shields for just making it work. So if you have a moment, stop by and visit the program. It's amazing.
Personal Services Department for our English Learners Program. And some of the information I'm sharing with you, she's had a big part of organizing this and making it happen, and that's our CTEL prep classes. She has been our lead in organizing all of the materials, preparing other presenters, presenting herself, and keeping track of all of our teachers who are requesting those classes and how they're doing. And so I'd like to share some of that with you. Dr. Matakovich mentioned that our enrollment is up. Well, our enrollment of English learners is also up. A year ago in October, we had 888 English learners, and just to give you a perspective, that was twice as many as 9 years previous. Okay, so we've been on this steady increase of English learners. In February of 2009, we reported 906 English learners, so even during the year, we increased our numbers. And I checked today, and we have 962 English learners. So we continue to increase our numbers. And so we continue to focus on that area, and we still have a great need to have more of our English, more of our teachers receive their EL or earn their EL authorizations. About a year ago, we determined we had 134 teachers in our district who still needed to earn their EL authorizations, 29 of them at the elementary school level and 105 at the secondary level. Of those 134, some of them, 37, participated in CTEL classes last year. We had 8 classes spread out through the year. We've had, of those 134, 26 teachers take and pass all 3 parts of the CTEL. And just so you know, the CTEL changes. The CTEL that some teachers took in December was revised and is different from the one that was then offered in June. It's offered twice a year. 4 have passed 2 parts, and 8 have passed 1 part of the CTEL. So of the 37 teachers who studied last year in our classes, so far we know that 65% of them have taken and passed one or more parts of the CTEL. We're still getting information. We had teachers test in June, and their results are still trickling in. And so we'll update our data as we see that. For this year, we also had summer CTEL prep classes. We had 19 teachers participate. It was after the CTEL date, so they won't take their test until December. But part of what Vicki has helped us to do is to organize refreshers. And so just before they take the test, we have sessions, voluntary sessions, for them to come and study and prepare. This year, we want to offer two sessions, one in the fall and one in the spring. We have 22 teachers signed up for our fall CTEL prep classes, and we're still accepting more teachers. Spring, there aren't as many right now. We have three, but of course, that number could go up during the year. And so what our department is doing is we update our principals and our staff, and we about all the different options they have for earning this EL authorization, and we're going to continue to do that for as long as we need to. Thank you.
Thank you, Mrs. Dockscamp. Are there any questions? Okay. Then moving on to Mr. Miller, the status of the state budget.
There's really no new information of any import. The state continues to struggle with its revenue projections and then measuring the actuals. They're short in the month of July. They were short $800 million. So what the prognostication is that sometime in December, the numbers will start coming out where they're $12 to $15 billion into the deficit. Much of that can be attributed to the most recent adoption of a budget that they've done. They fixed the deficit with a lot of one-time and borrowings and deferrals, and all of those will filter their way out and will still be left with $12 to $15 billion shortage. So what we are looking at in terms of the state's impact on our local district is that probably we'll be looking at mid-year cuts. Come December, January, we'll be back in front of the board and talking about reductions in revenues and how we're going to handle that in terms of paying back the state. Other than that, they're struggling with the prison system reform and other issues that they can't seem to come to agreement on, and we'll just have to wait for them to enter into the age of enlightenment or whatever is going to save us from them. I'm not sure what.
Thank you.
Limit, because anything that goes over is counted toward the state's GAN limit. So we have a zero adjustment, as you can see on page 4.5, line 10. And with that, I'd like to recommend that the board approve resolution 020910.
I'd like to make that motion.
Mr. Buckman.
I'd like to make the motion.
Oh, make the motion. I thought I heard a question.
Not yet.
I'll second.
So, moved by Mr. Buckman, seconded by Mr. Millar. With a question, okay.
Julie, what happens to a school district if they exceed their GAN limit?
There's a line on here. I don't really know, because it almost never happens.
Never has.
There's a place on here that says, if not zero, report amount to Michael C. Ganes, director at State Capitol.
Oh, okay. It almost,
and then I guess we find out.
When you look at all the stuff that's... I actually tried to read through the calculation again this year, and it's a rigged outcome, because all the stuff they exclude and include and stuff. Anyway.
Do you want to know a secret about this calculation?
Yes.
Is if the calculation shows that the district is overspending its allocation, it petitions the state to use part of its reserve of amount that's available, and the state will grant you the right to use their share in order to keep you under the GAN limit. It is one of those ill-conceived pieces of legislation which is fraught with loopholes and backdoor avenues to making sure you never have a consequence from the calculation itself.
Okay, we have a motion by Mr. Buckman, second by Mr. Millar. This is a roll call vote.
Mr. Buckman.
Yes.
Mr. Millar.
Yes.
Dr. Eisendrath Rogers. Mrs. Rogers.
Yes.
Mr. Spadafore.
Yes.
Mr. Unger.
Yes.
Mr. Angel.
Aye.
Passes 7-0.
Okay. Moving to item 5, an action discussion item. Approval of unaudited year-end actual financial statement for 08-09. Again, Julie Lang.
Thank you. We've closed the books for 2008-2009, and we're presenting our unaudited actuals tonight for your approval. We've also made some necessary changes to the 2009-2010 budget that you will also be approving with this item. I'm going to go over all the different funds and the changes that have occurred in them, and then Russell is going to go into more detail with the general fund summary. So starting with the general fund, you can see that our revenue and transfers in amounted to $77,598,000. Of that, $2,323,000 was a transfer from the adult education 2008 ending balance, which was allowed with the final budget that passed. Our expenses were $72,244,000. Of that, that includes our approved transfer out to Fund 20 for our post-employment benefits of $3 million. We made a transfer of $300,000 for our deferred maintenance match, and then we made another transfer back into the adult ed fund of $571,587 in order to balance that fund. The increase to the ending fund balance ended up being $5,354,695, and Russell's going to go into more detail about that when he talks about the general fund summary. Adult ed received revenues in the amount of $2,132,000. That included state apportionment, interest, and adult ed fees. Expenses were $2,514,000, and so you can see why we had to make that transfer back into the fund, because we expended more than we actually received. The fund ended the year with a balance of $190,216, which includes their 3% for economic uncertainties. In addition, because that sweep of the 2008 ending balance we didn't find out about until after we'd passed or adopted the budget, when we made that transfer in, we had to transfer money in the 2009-10 budget back into the adult ed fund to cover the expenditures that are budgeted there. So we made a transfer in 2009-10 of $1,302,140 in order to balance the 9-10 budget in the adult ed fund. And that's the most significant change we made to the budget. Deferred maintenance is also one of the restricted, what used to be restricted, resources that's now considered unrestricted. Revenues are going to come into Fund 01. We're going to transfer the revenues into Fund 14 and account for all the expenditures in Fund 14. The district is also planning on continuing to make its deferred maintenance match balance. We will eventually bring that back to you to close the fund out. Tax override, I mentioned before, we transferred most of the ending balance of that into the building fund. We also transferred $130,000 into the debt service fund so we could pay off the Vicente lease. The tax override fund ended up ending the year with a 96-cent balance, and we're going to keep that open because we do still have tax levies that trickle into that. Right? I think so far this year we've received about $15. And then the debt service fund is what we used to pay the Vicente lease. We paid that off this year, ended up saving the district about $19,000 in interest payments. We're going to keep that fund open because we still receive revenues from the County of San Luis Obispo and pay their portion of the lease out of that fund. And the only other changes to the 2009-10 budget that we made other than that adult ed transfer were just coding changes that the state hadn't informed us of when we adopted the budget. So it's just a change between revenue accounts, basically. Okay. And with that, any questions? And then I'll turn it over to Russell.
Do you have a question? Yeah. Mr. Buckman?
First of all, I want to thank Russell. These were the questions that I had, and we're down to one.
Well, I want to thank Russell.
It's in talking to Russell, I understand we captured $4 million in savings from school sites and departments, and I'm just wondering if staff feels that we might want to lower beginning allocations based on that savings so that we sort of ensure savings in the year coming up.
We have done that. Are you going to address that?
Yeah, part of our abilities that the state granted us was to sweep the carryovers, and we've done that, and that's part of the $4 million. Mr. Buckman, his questions, and whichever ones we haven't answered because of that, I've got a little bit of insight into our final results that probably will help clarify a significant number of issues. Let me go ahead with that. If I could get you to turn to your general fund summary, it's that three-column summary of the numbers at the end. It's on page 5.4. Thank you. And what I'd like to direct you to is a couple of significant numbers. In the first box, we talk about our revenues, and you'll see revenue limit, and then you'll see federal income. And the federal income increased by $900,000 between the second interim budget of 08-09 and the final numbers of 08-09. Remember, what we're discussing here is the unaudited actuals for the fiscal year 08-09. This has nothing to do with the budget for 09-10. This is our actual results of operations from last year. So what we ended up getting was the ARRA federal stimulus money on the last 2 weeks of the fiscal year, and it attributes $900,000 to our revenues, which were unlooked for to come in 08-09. We thought they would come in 09-10, but we have to account for them when we receive them. If you go down to the employee benefits line, which is probably about six, seven numbers further than that, in the 08-09 unaudited actuals column, it represents $11,631,000. And that's about $1.2 million less than we had budgeted to spend. And we saved that much money by receiving a holiday from premium from our health insurance company on a distribution of reserves. So they gave us 1 month we didn't have to pay for that we had anticipated paying for, and that saved us $1.2 million. If you look at the next line down, it represents a number of $3,500,000, which represents a $4 million savings, which can be significantly credited to the school sites, administrators, and departments for their careful management of the budget. As we saw the approaching storm from the state's perspective coming at us, we talked to the principals about tightening down spending, making sure that they bought essential things and didn't go into areas that were for product that they might not need in that year. And surprised in terms of the size. Not that we saved something, but that we actually saved $4 million in spending. And that goes to Mr. Buckman's point that if we were able to do that, maybe we need to drop our allocation. And I would say to that particular point, we're pretty much doing that. We have made a commitment to the sites that we are going to fund their essential expenditures for programs. We have no intention of trying to compromise our highly successful programs. We want the kids to succeed as they have in the past, and we're going to give resources for that to happen. In the perspective of saving money for the future, this is an area that we will be able to manage very carefully as we go forward with the year. The next number I point your attention to is under total expenses, there's a long line called transfers in, and the amount is $2,323,184, and absolutely devastated the next. So what we have as a safeguard for any kind of a catastrophic dip in our revenues is by putting a savings account aside. And what we are proposing with the unaudited actuals and the piece that we're asking you to consider and discuss tonight is increasing our reserve for economic uncertainty from 5% to 10%. And the authority to do that rests with the board. The recommendations for doing so come from a number of sources besides staff. School Services of California and the lobbyist groups, Schools for Sound Finance, or SF Squared, have had a position for several years that you cannot have enough reserves as a basic aid district until you reach a reserve level that equates to the amount of revenue you receive in excess of your revenue limit. And for us, that would be significantly more money than what we find in a 10% economic uncertainty reserve. So in terms of what some of our peers are doing, we see that their reserves, there was a survey done by Schools for Sound Finance, And I'll just read you some of the reserve percentages that were part of the response from these groups. 10%, 8%, 22%, 4.25%, 32%, 99%, 18.6%, 10%, 13%, 18%, 17.5%. There were several other numbers. I only picked out those that might be relevant. But other basic aid districts have recognized the need to put aside significant reserves. And joining with the recommendations of Schools for Sound Finance, staff feels like a 10% is a good beginning point for starting to put together a mechanism that should we lose our basic aid status, we won't have a catastrophic fall off the edge of a cliff. We'll have more, hopefully, of a downward glide that we can have a planned landing that we can attribute to having enough money to be able to keep programs intact. So what you see on is section number 5 is a number of $7,224,000. That would be 10% reserved for economic uncertainty. Below that in the next section is the $859,889 number, and it's called federal ARRA categorical stimulus money. That's the $900,000 I attributed up there in the revenue section for the federal income. In our discretionary, it's called flexible resource balances. It's part of section number 6. And the very last number of section number 6 is $4,688,000. That represents the amount of swept categorical carryover money that we're putting aside in a reserve account. And then finally, number 9, that number represents the undesignated reserve. The reserves that are left that don't have a specific purpose or intention as recommended by staff to the board or adopted by the board in past policy, and that number is $2.7 million. We also have one other event which has come clear in the last 2 or 3 days. Central Services gets together at 2 o'clock every day and looks at our enrollment numbers. And a reversal in our declining enrollment has occurred this year. We're up 145 to 147 kids over the previous years. That number is significant in my perspective, a significant number because we get no money for that. What we are getting is 147 students to serve with no additional revenues. And so it's significant for us to prepare, perhaps. This is still a little early to call, but we might be starting to see an increasing enrollment numbers for our district as opposed to our past history of declining enrollment. If that's true, then we're going to have to hire teachers, provide facilities, supplies, and all those other issues that an increasing student population calls for. So keep in mind as we go forward that increasing enrollment, while in a revenue limit district is a hungrily looked for occurrence, in our particular case, it doesn't present us fiscally with a lot of positives. Programmatically, it presents us with some great perspectives in terms of variety and other opportunities for programs, but financially it is an issue for us. I think that accounts for the significant issues that are found on the summary, and if you have questions, we're ready for them.
Okay, Mr. Spadafore.
Russell, a couple of things. When you refer, just for clarification on terminology.
And if their sunset of these rules cause us to have to account for what we did with it during the time when it was unrestricted, we want to be prepared for that. Mm-hmm. If it doesn't, we haven't lost anything, and we can actually identify where the money came from, how we used it. It might be good for internal purposes later to figure out how much of our checkbook was overdrawn for whatever reasons and how we were able to solve that problem. So that's why you see those numbers still there.
Okay, they're unrestricted now, but they're being treated as restricted. restricted for that reason.
Just for accounting purposes, okay. For identifiers, yes.
And then the other question I had, I remember the last demographic study about school enrollment.
Uh-huh.
It's not reflecting what's happening this year. Are we marching forward somewhat blindly now without any good indication of what happening in the district relative to student enrollment for the next?
No. Okay. I mean, what has happened to us is probably unlooked for, but not without cause. I think that the economic conditions of the state and the federal government has limited the number of students that are transferring into private schools. And so many families find themselves in an area that they need to save some money along the way. They're putting their kids back into public schools. That's one aspect. The other aspect is the multifamily housing that's probably going to take place now as it did in the past. It's 2-3 families living in the same home. So people from out of the area are moving in because a relative has a home with some room that they can make available to them. Kids have to go someplace, they're going to school. There will be several of those kinds of factors. They're not necessarily unlooked for, and we're not sure to treat them as long. That's why I said it's a newly developed. We're not sure whether to treat them as long-term developments or just short-term blips. But in terms of our facilities and our demographics, I think we have to trust to the long-term view as opposed to the short-term until it develops itself, and then we'll decide what to do with it then.
Okay, Mr. Angel.
A comment, then a few questions. In general, my position in the past has been that I'm against squirreling away a lot of money because I feel the money we get now is for the kids we have now. Having said that, I'm looking to the future, and I see we have a $2.8 million cut coming in 10-11, so I don't see that as squirreling away money for the long term. I see it as planning for the next couple of years. Before I approve a reserve, though, I want to make sure that we're not hitting any kids in the classroom with these cuts. And so when you talk about department cuts, what does that mean for the classroom budgets?
What we have as one of our goals is that we will have no program cuts in 09-10. Mm-hmm. Okay, we don't know what's really going to happen in 10-11, 11-12. So right now we have a one-year vision in terms of our commitment to programs that are part of our strategic plan and part of our core programs. We're going to keep those going with the same funding level as we had in 08-09. Mm-hmm. So the kids themselves won't see any of the cuts in terms of programs that make a difference. And what I would say to you is I'll define those. A specific example would be after-school program and summer school. Okay, we're going to fund those programs even though the funding for them isn't there or has been cut dramatically by the state of California. The things that we're looking at would be maybe professional development or textbooks or other things like that that we might not go forward with in 09-10 because they're not going to impact kids. So we still have that discussion that we have to continue with staff, and we'll come back with some recommendations if it means a change for the board to consider those.
Will classroom budgets be taken a hit as far as supply
budgets?
Classroom budgets as far as supplies and
no,
whatnot.
We made our same allocation as we have in years past.
Excellent. And then with the ARRA monies, are we supplanting anything with that, or are we actually enhancing our programs?
What we will do is with our Title I ARR monies, we're going to supplement. With our IDEA money, there will be some supplanting, which is allowed under the laws, and there will be some supplementing also. So there would be two characteristics under the IDEA. The other programs are all supplement. What you try to do is avoid supplanting, but where the law allows a release of the maintenance of effort in terms of special ed and a release of the encroachment money that we spent in the past and replacing it with some of this ARRA money, mm-hmm. then that's what we're going to do. We're going to follow the rules. We're going to be very careful about it. We're going to stay out of areas where we can get ourselves into difficulty.
Thank you. With conversations with you and Dr. Valentine, I do support a reserve at this
You indicated that with the increase in enrollment, there's no real increase in our funding. I'm wondering whether that also applies to categorical funding.
No, in some aspects, depending on the demographic area that you see the increase, you could receive additional categorical funding. But remember, we've lost 20% of our state categoricals, and Title I funding was down, I think, 16%, Mary? It took a hit. 14 or 16% sticks in my mind. Mm-hmm. But even the federal programs were underfunded this year as opposed to last year.
And under the old District of Choice program, which actually suspended this year, but there's legislation to put it back in place, basic aid districts that accepted students from outside were actually allowed to recapture 70% of the ADAs. So we might want, if that passes this year, we might want to look at
there is an
attracting
aspect,
students.
Yeah. For transfers in from neighboring districts that gets an allocation from those districts into our coffers of 70%.
Okay, Dr. Eisendrath-Rogers.
Thank you. Our principals and our sites are to be commended for being so frugal and saving that $3,500,000 there in materials and supplies. But now I'm wondering, since we have a little more to work with, if we could loosen some purse strings and make it possible. I understand that we're not going out and looking for new textbooks to commit to at this point, but, for example, textbooks in the classroom so that students don't have to carry their books back and forth. Materials, you know, even down to copying and Xeroxing, I know that's been very tight.
Yeah.
Can we loosen that up a bit?
Yeah, I think that what we need to remember is that one of the aspects of why we're saving money and why we're reserving specific amounts for specific purposes is because we're uncertain of our future. And while the board has the ability and the perhaps the need in order to address that particular issue or any number of issues for that matter, at the moment, I would tell you that without knowledge of how we're going to play out in the economy over the next 3 years or 4 years, a purchase of surplus textbooks for that purpose might not be as wise, perhaps, as a teacher's job. Or, in other words, I'd hate to buy $1 million worth of textbooks today and have to reduce our workforces tomorrow because we don't have the money in the bank to be able to pay teacher salaries for that extra year to bridge through a problem that might or might not occur. It's almost like looking in a crystal ball that's really, really cloudy, but you don't know, and you hate to make the call. But at the same time, I think that the old adage of you know, planning for the worst and hoping for the best really is something we need to operate by until the states and federal economic condition comes clearer. To do otherwise might put us in jeopardy of not being able to staff properly for the benefit of kids.
Thank you.
Okay, I'll chime in now. I think it was 3 or 4 years ago at CSBA that Schools for Sound Finance advocated going to a 10% reserve. And they made a very strong case for the volatility, the potential volatility of our funding sources. And so I have wanted this to happen, and I'm very supportive of it. I don't think that we do it at the cost of program. I think we provide excellent programs. I think we have two stated objectives, one of which is to maintain employment, and the other, excellence of program. And I don't want to be in a position to have to lay anyone off or in making mid-year cuts not to have the resources so that we have to call a halt to home-to-school transportation except where it's mandated suddenly and students are hurt and bus drivers are laid off. You know, there are so many examples of where we could just be forced to cut AP programs, cut reading recovery, and children who otherwise would be served we will have a period where we don't have to truncate anything immediately, what you like to call a soft landing. And I just think that's very wise. So I am fully supportive of it. I do have a couple of questions, though, about SIP funding in the coming year and categorical flexibility. When we get that bill from the state and we have to tell them.
We have, as the board and staff, is the idea that no program will be shorted in 09-10 that was funded in 08-09.
Okay, then my second point would be, I'm with Catherine on commending the school sites for being very prudent with their funds and being able to save us so much money. And I'm also with Catherine on, I don't want it to be at the expense of real school needs. I have had parents come to me in the past, I mean, with just the most basic, there's no Kleenex in my child's classroom, and when I ask why, I'm told I don't have funds for Kleenex. So I don't want to get down to that point ever, particularly in a year where swine flu looms large. I mean, I want to make sure that we have the basic things that we need beyond books and pencils and what have you. You know,
I could tell you from my being able to view the internal workings of a school site budget, there is no school that couldn't afford to buy Kleenex should they wish to.
So maybe some teachers are making a point. I don't know, but I want both the students and the teachers to have the Kleenex and other things that they need. I don't want those things to be considered incidentals.
We have developed some ideas about how to deal with the sanitary and other essential needs for health and those, and we're going to implement those without regards to the school site budget. So that particular concern, just so you know, won't be compromised by some school site's lack of funding.
Excellent. Thank you for your hard work, Mr. Miller. Mr. Millar.
Thank you. I noticed perhaps, I think for the first time, after looking at a few of these, that when we have a reserve for economic uncertainty, there are certain funds that also have to have a reserve built into their budget. So if we up the reserve to 10%, is the cafeteria fund and the adult ed fund going to have to bump their reserve? Or are they?
No. Actually, the other fund's reserves are just a result of their operations.
I see, not a specific budgetary goal.
The general fund is the only one that's mandated by law to have it, and for our size district, it's mandated at 3%.
Okay. And then I just would like to make a comment. I think what's most disturbing to me on this round of budget cuts, and I was the last faint hope that I had was extinguished tonight in closed session, is that we've shared the pain with revenue limit school districts. In fact, depending on how you parse the numbers, we may have taken a little bit more pain. There's absolutely no mechanism to pay back basic aid school districts. So the stuff they talk about for revenue limits in a year or two, we'll pay this back, we'll pay that back, that's not going to happen for us. So I think that speaks volumes about what we should do with our reserves.
The $250 per ADA cut that equates to the $1.7 million that the state's taking from us is a mechanism for revenue limit districts where they're taking it out of their revenue limit. And actually, it was in order to manipulate Prop 98 that they did this. And then they're going to put it back into their revenue limit as a one-time allocation in this particular 09-10 year. So they shorted 08-09. They put it back in 09-10. It's almost a paper, I don't say paperless, it's almost a transparent transaction to revenue limit districts. Yet for us, it's a invoice that we will receive from the state to pay for. And just a final point in terms of the board's goals and the district's outlook for the future, we were able to call back all 23 temporary teachers primarily because we had one-time money allocated in our reserves. When the state came out with the $1.7 million cost as fair share of pain for us, we immediately knew we had enough money in reserves to call the teachers back. And the next day, Mr. Robinette was on the phone returning those teachers to service. That's the kind of purpose to which we want to make sure that our reserves are capable of performing. Next year, we know what the pain is already going to be as a minimum. It's $2.8 million. it potentially will grow as mid-year cuts come onto the horizon. But clearly, $2.8 million is available in this document. At the very bottom last number, the unappropriated reserve is $2.7 million. So there actually is enough money within this document to bridge through next year's pain as we know it at the moment.
Mr. Unger.
I just want to make a couple of other comments. The thing that disturbs me about a lot of the money we're talking about is that it's one-time money. And we've always felt that we should spend one-time money on one-time things. The second thing that occurs to me is the number 85, because it's 85% of our total budget is for employees and our staffing costs. And when we talk about programs, I just want to remind everybody on the board and everybody who's listening that that we approve the unaudited year-end actual financial statement for 2008-2009, and that we follow the staff recommendation to protect our staff to increase our reserves to 10%.
Okay, and there was a second, Mr. Buckman. So moved by Mr. Unger and seconded by Mr. Buckman. And now public comment, Mr. Bedrigian.
Thank you. Bruce Bedrigian, President, San Luis Coastal Teachers Association. It's nice to see all of you again. Thanks. I want to speak here just and try and provide a teacher perspective, because I'm hearing from teachers. The teachers looked at this at the board minutes, and they were looking at these funds and where they were going, and I appreciate Russell breaking it down for us. And I guess as far as speaking in that vein, you know, the state requires 3% in a reserve budget. You all know that. We've kept 5 here, and nobody's complained about that. We want to be fiscally conservative. We understand that. But to go from 5% to 10% and think that is not going to go ahead and affect operations, I disagree with that. I could see going up modestly as a cautionary move, like Russell said, maybe it goes up to 6%. And maybe we look at things again next year, and maybe then it has to go up again. But what happens if next year Russell comes back and says, hey, there's another $8 million or $12 million surplus that we weren't expecting, has happened this year? What if that happens? So, you know, the Teachers Association is looking at this figure and also looking at the millions that are going into GASB again, that GASB fund. And as far as from a teacher perspective, we're looking at we have more children with special needs that are coming into the regular classrooms and being mainstreamed. And that's probably the number one complaint I receive from teachers, is that we're filling out supplemental forms, we're asking the district for help, and there's no help. Categorically across the board, those forms are being denied on a regular basis. So what are the teachers asking for? Well, they have several students in there that are special needs students. They want to work with the student in there. They just need an aide in there. They need some help. Those are being denied. So, you know, I'm thinking you can't have it both ways. You know, like Marilyn's point saying, hey, are they going to cut in the classroom? And Russell's saying, no, they're not going to be cut in the classroom. And I'm saying, yes, they are. And we're seeing it now. We have textbooks, we're told, they're already 2 years over, and now we're going to keep them again. We're going to say, oh, these are going to have to last. This is what we're being told in the trenches, in the classrooms, at our department meetings. You're going to have to keep those English textbooks. They're going to have to go a couple more years. And that's fine. Okay, we'll go for it because of the economic conditions. You have teachers accepting and taking a modest pay raise because it's saying, okay, you know, we didn't get what we wanted. We'll take a modest pay raise because we understand. You know, we are in this together and we want to work with you. But, you know, you can't have it both ways. That's going to happen. And Marilyn's comment about Kleenexes, and everybody laughs, but we don't have Kleenexes. You can't get a Kleenex box. And that's why so many teachers at our school have gone to tissue paper and they put it on the wall and students use it on the roll because it's less expensive and teachers are bringing in their own rolls. I just say be modest with this decision. That's all I want to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Bruce.
Hey, bye.
Mr. Buckman.
Russell, though we put this money in the reserve, can we, as a district or as a board, tap into this money later in the year? It's not locked into the reserve, or is it locked into the reserve?
No, it's not locked. It's just money that you've designated for economic uncertainties that might occur. And should an economic uncertainty occur, you go in there and you get it, and you bridge through it, and it helps you get a soft landing.
Oh, Mr. Angel.
How old are the textbooks that we have that we're postponing ordering?
Well, I think Mr. Bedrigian referenced the English textbook adoption, which is slated for this year. However, there's legislation coming forward to allow all school districts to delay that adoption for
further discussion. We have a motion on the table moved by Mr. Unger and seconded by Mr. Buckman. Those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That passes unanimously. Moving on to item 6. Dr. Valentine, did you want to pull one of the board policies on item 6?
I'll defer to Dr. Matakovich.
Yes, but I will do that as we go through the sequence, okay, if that's okay.
So then we have 4 proposed revisions to board policies affected by cyberbullying. A is board policy 5131, student conduct.
Okay. If I may, I'd like to make some general comments and
please,
then take each of the policies one at a time, if I may. Thanks to your organization, the California School Boards Association, cyberbullying has come to our attention. It's arisen out of this technology age that we're in. And when we look at cyberbullying, it falls under the prohibited student conduct category of harassment of other students and staff. As stated in the first policy, the conduct policy, cyberbullying includes the transmission of communications, posting of harassing messages, direct threats, social cruelty, or other harmful texts, sounds, or images on the internet, social networking sites, or other digital technologies using a telephone, computer, or any wireless communication device on or off campus. It also includes breaking into another person's electronic account and assuming the person's identity in order to damage the person's communications, reputation, or friendships. We have experienced very few incidences to date in this area, and I want to thank the staff for their close supervision of our students, for properly supervising them, and their ability to create a positive school climate with clear student conduct rules. Solid instruction, which promotes communication, social skills, and assertiveness skills, helps to educate our students about appropriate behavior. So in our staff review of these policies, there are 4 that needed revisions. I'd like to walk through each one of them and take any questions, comments, changes, as this is the first reading of each of these policies. So starting with the conduct policy, which is 5131 on page 6.2, we want our students to have the right to be educated in a positive learning environment, and we want appropriate behaviors. As you can see from this policy, there's a listing of inappropriate behaviors, and we've added under the harassment category cyberbullying. And I've already defined for you what it is, but Also, along with the definition of cyberbullying, we've also added an overview of the process for processing a complaint in this area. Those are two changes we've made to the policy. As well, there's a second. So how about if I just take that section right now with comments from you and then go on to the next section of this policy?
Okay. Mr. Spadafore.
Okay, thank you very much, Marilyn. Dr. Matakovich, when I looked at this, there was something that seemed to be out of balance a little bit.
Okay.
The preamble, the first paragraph, second full sentence says, on school grounds and at school activities, just that portion.
Mm-hmm.
Yet under cyberbullying, it talks about on or off campus mm-hmm. events, if someone's at home or someone's at a cafe or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking to balance the preamble with the prohibition against cyberbullying, mm-hmm. would it be a good idea to put on school grounds and at school activities and also from outside school sites so the preamble is consistent with the cyberbullying so they're aware that it includes anything that affects a student or the school or the educational process when you get to the paragraph under cyberbullying with the preamble?
Thank you. Yes.
Mr. Buckman?
Yes, thank you. On 6.3, I have two recommendations, if I may, Madam President. The second paragraph at the top, the wording right now is students may submit a verbal or written complaint of conduct they consider to be bullying to a teacher or administrator as soon as possible. For me, it's a little vague. And what I'd like to recommend to the board that the Supreme Court decision revolved around the district not checking the truth of it. And possibly what we want to include, checking the veracity of the accusation, if not a life-threatening situation, so if it doesn't involve a gun or a knife or a threat. Those are my two comments on that page.
Okay. I don't know who was first, Mr. Angel or Mr. Millar.
I think it was me.
Okay, Mr. Millar.
I just want to ask Mark for a little clarification on that. The investigation would try to determine whether the facts that are stated by way of this cyberbullying, whether or not those statements are accurate?
I'm not sure that this only applies to cyberbullying, but yes, in that case, what happened in the recent Supreme Court decision was a young honor student in junior high school, because one student said that she was doing something illegal, the district went to the point of taking her in and searching her. And so the Supreme Court recommendation was that based on a single student's comment, it may not be enough to warrant that type of investigation, and that possibly there should have been more, at least a check with to see if other students had similar complaints.
Oh, okay. It was the case was one of the few times that I actually found myself agreeing with Justice Scalia in the dissent, which basically said, you've got to consider the context of what's going on. You've got a drug problem at school, and then this report comes up. So it was just a little aside. I don't often agree with Justice Scalia. One of my concerns about the... This actually kind of, I wish I could remember this site because I'm not trying to be funny, but it goes to the Bongs for Jesus case, where in that case, I believe the rationale dealt with the fact that this was a school-related event and they were at a parade.
Mm-hmm.
Kids at home on his family computer and misbehaves by doing something like this. Do we have the reach legally to make that conduct punishable by an action by the school district? And that's, I think that mm-hmm. we should at least try to nail that down while we're discussing some of the other search and seizure issues that caused the one item to be pulled.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was, if I may just repeat, I'm sorry, Phil, but a couple of things. I think it's apples and oranges here, and I think we need to be very clear on what we're talking about. And I may be wrong about cyberbullying, but it's electronic instead of somebody going up to another student and saying, you're an something or other, or I'm going to take you after school and do something to you. There's a threat here. Now, in cyberbullying, it's in writing. It appears on a computer.
No, I don't think that's true, John. I don't think it has to be in writing.
No, it let's just say cyberspace. It ends up on a computer. It ends up on a phone. It ends up somewhere. It's cyberspace. It's in there somewhere. So there's a record of it because there's a lot of case law going through computers and nothing is gone. Everything's discoverable. So it's in writing. So there's a document that says student A says something about student B. The case about the search in Arizona had to do with a teenage honors student that was search and seizure. It had to do with some students saying student A, a girl in that case who was 13, has prescription drugs or medication in her underwear. And the school decided, well, we'll take her aside and we'll undress her. That's that case. It's search and seizure. It's not the printing or the dissemination of bullying words against another student, totally separate. The Alaska case has to do with free speech, not directed against a student, which is what we're dealing with here. We're dealing with one student bullying another student in forms that usually aren't normally or aren't traditional, where in the classroom somebody stands up and says to that other student, you're so-and-so, and I'm going to intimidate you in any way I can. Now it ends up being on cyberspace. They're two different cases. It's not search and seizure, and it's not free speech. So I think if a student gets an email at home from a student who's at their home, that says, tomorrow at school, I'm going to go ahead and take care of you and do A, B, and C, that student should have the ability to take that memo to school and say, I'm scared. I'm being bullied by this student. And it happened off campus. To tie the school's hands by saying it happened at home, therefore we can't intervene, I think would be a poor result for the school district. It's in writing. It's proven. That's where you get the bullying. It's not search and seizure.
I think we're kind of off on the term search and seizure, and it was merely an example of the district.
Teenagers, the whole texting, and I'm not even going to get into it here. But on page 6.2, I wanted to add, nobody's going back, or maybe recommend that we add, sounds, images, using a telephone, computer, or wireless communication device. Okay, cyberbullying also includes breaking into another person's electronic account. I would like to suggest that we add breaking into or setting up a false account. It's very easy to set up a Facebook account, say I'm Chris Unger, and then post some really weird things. I should try that.
Madam
election year.
Sorry. I think,
Are you, and, Mr. Angel, you still?
Just one other question. On 6.3, I'm just making, I want to see, is there teeth to our program? Are we doing enough to protect our students? You know, what are the consequences? Because it didn't seem spelled out here.
That was going to be mine, too.
Oh,
was
I told you, Thunder, I'm sorry.
It says, any student who engages in cyberbullying using district-owned equipment on school premises or off campus in a manner that impacts a school activity or school attendance shall be subject to discipline in accordance with district policies and regulations. And this is the district policy and regulation, and it doesn't stipulate the punishment.
Well, this is a board policy, and our administrative regulations spell out the consequences.
Do they?
For student conduct, yes, as well as our conduct code. So we, with the approval of this, these changes, will change our student conduct code to reflect the addition of cyberbullying.
Might we have some idea of what a possible potential consequence could be if you could equate cyberbullying to a similar activity?
Well, you know, after the investigation and the determination that there's been an impact, then there is a conference, there is appropriate discipline. It could be as much as a suspension to detention, to a parent conference. It just depends on the extent of the incident.
So that would be a site-based decision?
It's in accordance with our conduct code, yes.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Matakovich. Mr. Buckman.
Dr.
Eisengrath Rogers.
Well, thank you, because I was going to support your notion, Mark. In terms of the hard evidence, John, that you brought up, the problem with programs like Facebook is that if a password gets out, and I think many of the kids know each other's passwords, you can pose as the person with the account. You can have the hard evidence of something they've said or done, and it isn't them. And so Mark's suggestion that we embed in here some kind of investigation that requires that among the peers, among the students involved, that there's some effort made to determine that there is some veracity to the accusation, I think could be important.
Mark had his light on first. I'm sorry, Walter.
I would like to hear what Walter says on that. I do have one other point, if I can just get it out on the table, and then we can come back to it. I think that would be wonderful.
I was just going to point out the term investigate is in the second paragraph on page 6-3, and as an old cop, investigate means determine the veracity of the accusations in the complaint.
Can you tell me the paragraph, Walter?
Second paragraph, it says, complaints of bullying or harassment shall be investigated and resolved in accordance with site-level grievance procedures specified in the ARs. So I was just going to point out the investigation part.
Madam President?
Yes, Mr. Buckley.
Thank you. On 6.4, on the center of the page, under possession of cellular phones and other electronic signaling devices, I think this is a wonderful paragraph. The one piece I have a problem with is we're going to take the cell phone away from a student, and the student will not get it back until there is a parent conference. And I'm very concerned as a parent. I wanted my child's cell phone, because she was often home alone. I wanted my child's cell phone, she was downtown, to be on when she got out of school so she could contact me or I could contact her. So what I'd like to recommend is that we strike the device may be held until a parent conference. I'm not sure what the statement would be, but the phone would be returned to the student at the end of the day, and parents of students' electronic signaling device issues shall have to schedule a parent conference. Many of our parents work to five or past. The schools are closed. There's not going to be an opportunity to get that cell phone back, so the student may be days without their cell phone.
Could we?
I'm having a problem, so I realized, and for this meeting, I typically look to the right, so I'm making a conscious effort to go to the left, because I can't ever tell whose mic is down first. And, Mr. Millar, I'm going to go to Mr. Angel.
But I was already speaking, if you recall. But that's all right. Okay.
Respectfully disagree with Mark's point. I believe cellular phones, iPods have no place in the educational environment. I lean with Templeton on that issue. They don't belong there, and if a kid is disrespectful enough to have it on campus, take it away and let the parents deal with it. You know, they have to learn.
Mr. Spadafor.
Thank you. I'll leave the cell phone discussion to my companions. I wanted to go back to the page before, under conduct, first sentence on 6.3. It says, school staff shall receive related professional development, including information about early warning signs, et cetera. Mm-hmm. What do you think, and has staff discussed this, that some of the professional development will be about new technology, what's happening in the electronics and computer field? Mm-hmm. Because I think, at my age, I don't know half of what students can interact with technologically. So I'm thinking if we're going to do professional development with staff, it maybe should include understanding how technology is developing and how students are using it, so they'll understand what is going on with the different means of communication. And then the other point was, fifth paragraph,
yes,
down. Any student who engages in cyberbullying using district-owned equipment on school premises or off-campus, and there again, off-campus appears, so to make everything consistent, in a manner that impacts a school activity, then I would put a comma, school attendance. But what about adding impacts school activity, comma, school attendance, comma, a fellow student or a staff member? Because there have been other schools that have had cyberbullying and problems with messages being transmitted that affect staff also. So I think that there should be, and I think at one point it was mentioned, that staff may be subject to cyber techniques that undermine their role as a teacher or in the classroom. So that would be, if there's any need for that, I don't know if there is. Okay.
I appreciate the ad, and if I could just comment, in our ed tech plan, we have a series of objectives in this area in terms of staff development, so I appreciate you pointing that out.
Okay, now, Chris Walter was up before you were.
Sure. Okay, I just wanted to express a concern about cell phones' involvement in cheating, and I know there's some reference to it in here, but first, in the classroom, is it a big issue? And secondly, if it is, do we need more stringent methods to make sure that it isn't an issue? So go ahead and answer the first one if you can, and then maybe we won't have to deal with the second one.
Well, we have a teacher here.
We do.
Who could comment on that. It's not my understanding that in meeting with the principals that this is a serious issue. They have their classroom rules, and they turn off their phones during class, and that's they conduct instruction without that distraction. If it's disrupted, then we follow the guidelines that we have here.
Okay. Cell phones. The ubiquitous presence of cell phones. I did something I've been wanting to do for a long time. I took a student's cell phone, and as I was going over my class expectations, I was talking about cell phones, how please don't, you know, I referenced the movie The Matrix and said, if you can't control your machines, the machines will control you. And so... And then a cell phone went off, and this little girl in the back, and I said, could I have your cell phone, please? And she gave it to me. She was embarrassed, and I took it up to the podium, and I held it on the corner, and I said, some of you are wondering my cell phone policy. And I picked up a hammer. I said, this is it. Smash. And a crystal went over there, and the pieces went across the floor. And you could see some of the students in the front cringing. I knew what they were thinking. They were thinking, oh, my God, I'm in class for the whole semester with a madman. And then finally one girl in the corner, she said, that wasn't really her cell phone, was it? And I said, no, I planted it with her, and she agreed to play this through. I said, but that's not the point.
Teachable moment.
A teachable moment. But exactly how would you like me to respond? What was the question?
Do you think cheating is a serious problem using cell phones in class?
If they're caught texting, that's different. That's not an accident. That's, oh, I forgot to turn it off. Texting is I'm deliberately choosing to text while other students are sharing ideas or we're discussing, oh, the teacher's up there lecturing. That's more serious. And for that, I told them they will receive a check, and I will turn it into the dean. They will not get it at the end of class, and then they have to track down the dean. But appreciate you taking the time trying to figure this out, because that's what we're dealing with, too. You can remember our first policy was no cell phones on campus, mm-hmm. but they came in with a wave. And so now it is no cell phone. Our school policy is no cell phones at all should be on during class. And that's including during any class. If you're out in the hall or anything, you're not allowed to have you be using a cell phone. They're okay at lunch, break, and after school, before school. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Where are we now? I think I have to go back. Chris?
Well, I was just going to say, I would be comfortable with parent contact. I think Mr. Bedrigian made the point for me. This is about defiance of authority. I'm just going to leave it at that.
Madam President?
Yes.
Thanks. Bruce, I think you're absolutely right. The original Ed Code allowed school districts to ban the electronic sending devices in schools after the Columbine incidents, where students were actively involved in tracing where the shooters were and helping the police. The policy changed, and so they could have the cell phones in school. However, having them on during class and texting is now still under the under the jurisdiction of the district. If there's no other comments, I might like to try and make a motion.
We have the other ARs to go through that they're taking them all at once.
Okay.
Or the board policies, rather. I beg your pardon.
This is a first reading, and we're taking your input, and we'll come back with another read and another if necessary.
Okay. So then, Dr. Matakovich, shall we move to board policy 5137, students, positive school climate?
Right. We've added a paragraph to the bottom of the first page, and since we feel that enforcing the board policies and regulations which result in appropriate student conduct, identifying what we prohibit against and listing those areas in this positive school climate policy, we think is important to tie it all together.
Mr. Spatterfor.
Thank you. I wanted to point out just in the consistency part that the section that was added includes staff along with students in terms of protecting a protected class. So if we're going to make it consistent all the way through, we go back to my part. I'm sorry I won't let that go, but I think the staff needs to be protected, even though they're very aggressive in their own teaching techniques, but that's a different thing. The other question I had was first paragraph.
John, where, Mark and I were looking for where you're talking
6.6.
About.
6.6, the paragraph that was added, this underlined, that Dr. Matakovich was referring to, it says threats of violence, it goes on cyberbullying, and da-da-da-da, against students and staff. So to make it consistent all the way through, it should be a clear message that we're dealing with protecting students and staff. The other question I had, first paragraph, second full sentence, the district shall provide instruction, counseling designed to promote positive racial and ethnic identity, and it goes on and talks about what the goals are. Is there a reason that we don't include sexual and sexual preference language? In other words, male against female, female against male, and then the issues that we've heard in the past before about students that may not be as masculine as some other people think they should be, being criticized for potential sexual preference identification. There's no mention of sexual or sexual preference in that first paragraph. I don't know if that's, but there's certainly definitely actions from boys against girls, girls against boys, and sexual preference comments throughout the school that we've heard at the board is not.
I agree with John on that. That I think that should be included.
There, if I may, Madam President.
Yes.
There is within Penal Code and Ed Code a definition of what would be considered discrimination, and it may fit very well here. And it does list those topics, the different categories.
Ms. Strunger.
I was just wondering if what you're also talking about doesn't fall under the sexual harassment board policies as well.
Good point. Any other comment on positive school climate? Okay, then we'll move on to board policy 5145.12.
Revised fashion, and we're looking at October 6th to bring
it
back.
Okay, and I just want to point out on page 6.8, on the 1, 2, 3, 4th paragraph, the last sentence ends with evidence may still be used in disciplinary proceeding unless it was illegally obtained. It makes reference to having two employees present during a search. I would like to make sure we understand that unless it was illegally obtained issue better, because I believe the discipline process involving students does allow us to use evidence that might not be admissible in normal administrative hearings or other criminal proceedings. And it still would be important, because the more important issue is whether the student was actually engaged in the conduct, and less to do with whether or not we meet some search and seizure criteria for prosecution.
Well, and actually, And actually, Mr. Millar, that was one of the areas that he addressed, and he suggested that we remove that unless it was illegally obtained. So we would like to go through this carefully and update it beyond what the suggestions are here.
So you don't
please.
Want You no, do you, or don't want comments or questions? Don't.
I don't. I think,
I'm happy to take them.
Do you want to take them, Mary? I don't.
I'll call you on it. Maybe need some clarification. I don't want to look that dumb on TV.
Okay. Just for clarification, when it comes back, it'll be a first reading anyway.
Yes, it will.
So
correct.
There'll be plenty of time and opportunity to discuss it at the first reading.
Thank you.
So then we move on to Board Policy 6163.4. Instruction, district technology, San Luis Coastal Net.
Right. Surprise, it's me again.
Hi. And if I could make a little statement, we're looking at changing the title to be in line with the CSBA titles, but also this policy has been updated by the Information Services Department. The emphasis is on age-appropriate instruction, the need to monitor students, and to provide measures to supervise their access to online resources. So I'm here to take your input.
Madam Chair?
I had no problem with this one. Mr. Buckman?
I'm sorry, I didn't. Minor things, and these are mostly in terms of, rather than protecting the rights of students, protecting the district. As we move along, and if there's any ever challenge to it, in the center of 6.10, use of district computers online, it seems as you read this that we are sort of guaranteeing or ensuring that the filters that we use will block internet access to visual depictions, blah 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 blah. Having worked as a computer lab tech in Lucia Mar with a similar situation that we were sort of guaranteed they couldn't get anywhere, at least twice last year, students were able to get to a cartoon. It's called anime, and it shocked me. So I'd like to recommend some terminology that's to the extent possible or with the latest technology, because I don't think we can guarantee students not getting where they shouldn't be. And then on page 6.11, I think it would be good to have a statement, or I'd like to suggest a statement that is toward maybe the last statement is that is similar to this. To ensure the district adopts changing technology and circumstances, the superintendent or designee shall regularly or annually review the policy and the AR and other pertinent documents to include the effectiveness of the filter system, so that we don't put a filtering system in place and then it just rides forward, and we haven't had a chance as a board and as a district to review whether there's new technology.
Where was that, Mr. Buckman, that you were reading from?
It's a wonderfully illegible note in my book that I wrote, and I'm more than willing to type it up if you would like.
Okay, I don't know who was up first.
I was.
Mr. Millar.
Thank you. I may not actually have been with
but I respond well to aggression.
Thank you. I think one of Mark's concerns about the guarantee aspect of it on the part of the district is not really a concern for me, because in that paragraph it says, to reinforce these measures, superintendent designee shall implement rules and procedures designed to restrict student access. That's not as going as far as making a statement saying we absolutely won't let anybody see stuff that's and I think your suggestions might fit well into an AR in support of this. So.
I'm sorry, Walter. I probably misstated which paragraph I was reading.
Or making less of an absolute guarantee, but I do think Mark's concerns about filtering technology and things changing every day is a valid one.
So maybe that word ensure just needs to be looked at again.
I do have a point on that, though, on that section.
John?
You know, the concern is real, and maybe we should have Mike Smith look at the second page, because I think on the last page, there's a hold harmless and a waiver of liability statement. And I think the reason you have that in this situation is because you can never guarantee that you can do anything with technology as it's intended, even firewalls and blocking. So I think that statement, which is a hold harmless statement and waiver of liability, may protect the district if a student gets through to something that's inappropriate, and that's probably the reason it's there. So I would recommend that all we do is ask Mike Smith if the reason there is a hold harmless and waiver of liability section is to protect us from that concern that Mark raised, because you never can stop technology from either being broached or being changed. So I think it's impossible unless you have a waiver of liability and a hold harmless clause, and that's probably the reason it's in there. So I think we may be okay if Mike Smith says that protects us.
Okay. I may, real quick, no. I just have some concerns about the whether that hold harmless is even effective. You're giving up prospective rights of a parent in order to enroll your child in public education.
Yeah, that's why I think Mike Smith to look at to see if it's doing what we intended to do to protect the district. Yeah, I think you're right about that.
Okay, Mr. Unger.
The only other caution I would make about this particular section is there are no child left behind requirements that we're obligated to basically ensure that our students don't have access to pornography, obscene materials, and things like that. And that's one of the things, the assurances that we have to sign when we sign for our No Child Left Behind allocations. So I think we need to be real cautious about the language we use here and make sure that it aligns to what the feds are requiring.
Okay, and Dr. Matakovich, is this pretty much language that came from California School Boards Association? Thank you.
Thank you for your input, and we'll come back with these policies at the next meeting.
Thank you for your patient note-taking on this. There's a lot of discussion. Okay, we'll move on to item 7. Proposed revision to board policy number 6171, instruction, Title I programs. Mrs. Delkus-Camp.
Thank you. Similar to other items presented this night, this is a revision to an existing board policy. The revisions we've made are to align our policy to the recommended language that CSBA offers. And before I take your questions, I just wanted to clarify. We did receive a question. I looked into this and was able to clarify that on page 7.2 in the very first sentence, we dropped a word there as we were working through the drafts. It should say, in order to improve the academic achievement of economically disadvantaged students, is the wording that CSBA recommends to us. Mm-hmm. Other than that, as stated in the board item, you see that there's a new part added about the LEA agency plan, the LEA plan, I mean, local educational agency plan that wasn't in that policy before, and also some additional wording on comparability of services.
Mr. Buckman.
Surprise. Rita, I think this is going a long way to ensuring comparability between schools for students. I did have one concern on the comparability portion. As we look at the center of the page and we go through the five steps towards comparability, under those five steps is the statement, in determining comparability, the district shall not include staff salary differentials for years of employment. And I'm wondering if we could substitute, if in my mind what came is I could substitute for staff salary differentials for years of employment just the word experience. Because that's what that amounts to.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe if I provide some other information, it might help to determine whether we want to make a change there or not. Just so that you know, The way our district determines comparability of services is through number 2, where it says the ratio of students to teachers, administrators, and other staff at each Title I school shall not exceed 110%. And
Fernando Valley, and I'm not sure that this isn't addressed in the Williams settlement, but my concern is, and in fact Russell recently just said, we would be sorely lost if we lost all our experienced teachers. That they're valuable. So my concern is that by eliminating our ability as a district to create comparability balanced on experience and inexperience, I just think we're limiting ourselves.
Mm-hmm. I guess we would want to think about also that just because you have more years of experience and hence are earning more money doesn't necessarily make you a better teacher than somebody who doesn't have as many years of experience. I bet we might find both sides of that coin on along the whole spectrum of experience.
Yes.
Dr. Valentine?
I'm sorry. I can defer to Mark and let him finish his comment and then jump in. I think we want to avoid situations where we're looking at any kind of involuntary transfer of staff members because we have more higher-paid teachers at one site than another in the name of comparability. I think that'd be a difficult position for us to be in. I think the analogy between a massive school district like LA Unified and San Luis Coastal, the analogies may not carry into our district as clearly.
And just to beat this for the last time, it may not necessarily involve involuntary transfers. It may just involve leaving teachers at the sites that they are so that they can share their experiences because I don't always learn everything that I need in classes or in staff development. Sometimes it takes a teacher with experience to share and to do the best job with students. And so I still feel that this is limiting the district and is detrimental to us in trying to close the achievement gap.
We would not move a teacher involuntarily based on their experience, so they can stay at the school they are.
I'm sorry, I thought you said that this could be a problem because we don't want to move teachers involuntarily.
Yeah, as I said, we do not move teachers involuntarily, and as a result, teachers would be permitted to stay in the schools they are and would not be shifted involuntarily to somewhere else.
Any further discussion of this item? Okay, so that will be coming back to us at the next meeting. Item 8, proposed revisions to board policy number 6020, instruction, parental involvement.
Okay, these two board items are presented together because, as you may have noted in the board item, there's been some shifting of some of the contents from one board policy to the other. And so what this board policy does is before where the Title I parent involvement was part of the Title I board policy, now it's just a component of this parent involvement policy. One thing, so you have both Title I and non-Title I school components in here, and then there is one new requirement that we've implemented because we were aware of this need, and that is that now our Title I schools need to develop school-level parent involvement policies. And so those will become part of their single plans for student achievement. Questions?
Mr. Spadafore.
Comments?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much for the presentation, Rita. Comment, when my two daughters were at San Luis Coastal at every level, there was parent involvement, and it was pretty safe to say it was from a certain demographic at that point, and that's a while back, although I don't want to give the years. last year when I went to open house out on the coast and at C.L. Smith and at Pacheco, The teachers who had EL classes said that the parent involvement in their classes had tripled in a year. And I'd gone the year before in some of the classes, and there were 10 people. Now there were 35 people at certain activities. So I think this speaks to what's happening. And I think San Luis Coastal has always had a strong parent participation to a certain degree with certain groups. And I think now we're seeing it expand to groups that were never fully included within the integration of a school site. And I think that's great. So I applaud you heavily. Thank you, Rita.
Thank you.
Any additional comment?
I have one more.
Okay.
I always think it's nice where it says the superintendent designee shall regularly evaluate and report to the board, that you put something in there that kind of...
any of these items pulled. Item 9, approval of certificated and classified personnel items. 10, approval to hire elementary class size instructional aides for 2009-2010. Item 11, acceptance of donations. Item 12, approval of furniture and equipment requests. Item 13, approval of purchase orders. Item 14, approval of warrants and payroll.
Move approval of items 9 through 14.
Second.
Moved by Mr. Millar and seconded by Mr. Spadafore. Those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That passes unanimously. Does anyone have anything that they would like to discuss regarding advance agenda?
Yes, please.
Okay, Mr. Buckman.
Thank you. I have to find the page. I'm sorry. Is it 17? No. 16. Thank you, Kim. I'd like to propose two agenda items. One probably will be in closed session, and one will be probably in open session. I think all of us received an email from Russ Rayborn on brain development and how it affects the changes that we're doing in education. I was fortunate enough at the Teacher of the Year dinner, I think 2 years ago, to listen to a very short presentation by Diane Barnhart on this same topic. And I think it would be of value to the board to at least have either Russ or Diane or both give the board just a brief public description of what they were both talking about. I find it very interesting, and I think it will affect the way we educate students in the future.
Diana Barnhart is retired.
Yes, she is.
So I don't know.
Is this the first step?
This is the first step. So we're looking for a second on that.
I'll second.
Thank you.
Okay, so... okay, so Mr. Buckman and Mr. Angel have proposed that the board have a presentation on brain development and educational approach. And so that will come back at the next meeting and they will have fleshed it out somewhat. Okay. And then, Mr. Buckman, did you have another one for closed session?
Yes, and I need to look to administration for direction on this. Brown Act often comes under closed session, and I have a specific topic under the Brown Act that I would like the board to review. Would that be better to submit in a different setting or to do it here in an open session? It's not a specific thing. It's a general part of the Brown Act. It's like I'm whispering in your ear.
No.
Yeah, there are certain things that can be discussed in closed session, and everything else cannot. And I guess we'd have to know the nature of it before we could pass a judgment.
Yes.
Is it a general Brown Act procedure or a specific allegation of a violation?
No, it's not an allegation of a violation. It's just a procedure that I think the board should review, and probably best is to be done in closed session, but I don't know.
I'm not sure that the tenets
of closed session will allow for that.
I'm not sure that would be allowed, but... yeah, I guess we could submit to the board president and clerk. We could look at it, and if you'd like to attend, that'd be fine too. And we'll look at it and see what.
So this one may be exempt from the support of another board member, or I could go out and talk to two other board members and see if one of them is important. Because I mean, I don't want to go.
I know what you're saying. Okay. I know what you're saying. But why don't we get what the topic is first, and then we can decide how to proceed in terms of processing it.
Thank you, Ed, and thank you,
Mr. Buckman. Do you feel a sense of urgency about that?
Probably before Thanksgiving.
So that if there was a bit of a delay while you expressed to Ed and Walter and myself, you know, what aspect of the Brown Act you want to discuss, and then if it were that you had to get support and bring it back and go through the process for it to be discussed in open session, it would get on certainly before Thanksgiving. So,
well, thanks, because I would like to be able to enjoy my turkey without
having it hanging over your head.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay.
I'd like to be able to enjoy my turkey in public. Let's put it.
Okay, Mr. Angel.
I would like to propose we get a report on where we are in becoming our classrooms are in becoming 21st century classrooms. So how many projectors we have, how many computers are in
additional funds minus the deficit factor, of course. In my conversations with other basic aid school districts around California, one of the things that is a concern to basic aid school districts is whether, in fact, children who are enrolled in our schools are actually residents of our school district. I have spoken to Dr. Valentine in the past about Newport Mesa School District, for example, which is the largest basic aid school district in California, and which has recently implemented a very stringent policy to check residency requirements for their students. I think residency checks would be a good thing not only for us because it would help our financial position, but it also helps other districts around financial positions. If kids are going to school illegally here, the school district where they would be entitled to go to school would collect the revenue limit from them. I would ask that we look at various ways of checking residency for our students. I know there are school districts that are doing that. And then I would ask for support in doing that and a proposal to come back to the board to see whether that's something that we would have an interest in implementing in this district.
So, can I just clarify one thing with Chris?
Sure.
Are you asking for some initial information in a Friday packet and then decide how?
I would be willing to go with information from a Friday packet, and then I would be willing to bring it back at that point. I know, for example, Newport Mesa, of course, it's a large school district. They found 1,400 students that didn't belong in their school district out of 30,000. It's a significant number of students. And I think that given the dire financial times, both for us and for other school districts, it might be something that we want to look at.
It's 5%. So then initially you would take that information. I'm sorry, I got a little lost. What would you like Dr. Valentine to provide in the Friday packet?
I would be satisfied at this point if Dr. Valentine could do some checking and report back to us in a Friday packet, maybe what other basic aid school districts are doing, so that information could be brought back, whether it's something the board might want to discuss and direct staff to do for the next school year, perhaps. So we've got some time on it, but it is a conversation that ultimately, perhaps with some more background information, we might want to engage in.
If I may.
Okay. Yes, Mr. Muller.
I think that's an excellent idea. Maybe there's some preliminary survey that we can do to make some initial determination as to how big a problem that is for us. I don't know whether you need to do a full-blown audit of students, but something that will indicate whether or not we have an issue that we really need to be worrying about.
You know what's interesting? Chris said that it was an X number of students out of 30,000 that were found. That's about 3%, it turns out to be. So that would be about 210 students here if 3% is what you see across the board, but it doesn't mean that's what you see.
Could be a lot of money.
210.
Okay, so Dr. Valentine, do you feel like you have clear direction there?
Yeah, we'll come up with some related information and see where you want to go with it.
Okay, thank you. Reports by board members. Mr. Angel.
I was recently came across a few extra binders for the California Association of School Leaders, and I was able to pass one on to Harley, and it goes over anything from conducting an ASB meeting to planning and putting on dances. I was hoping someone could forward this to the ASB at Morro Bay High. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Unger.
I just wanted to say Saturday I was able to go to, although not directly a school event, the Eagle Scout Court of Honor for Carson Zarek, who's a Los Osos resident. He's a member of Troop 214, which, by the way, celebrated its 10th anniversary this year. I was fortunate enough to be one of the founding assistant scoutmasters of the troop. It's a great bunch of boys. This is their 13th Eagle Scout. We've known some here. Joe Hernai, for example, was an Eagle Scout. These are kids that really contribute to the community, and I'd like to send my congratulations to Carson and his family.
Thank you. Mr. Beckman.
Thank you, Madam President. I did recently attend a weekend PTA leadership training, which I'll be sharing with the local schools. I'd like to remind everybody that Tom Torlakson will be here in the county September 17th, and he'll be staying at a very gracious family's home that, or not staying, he'll be visiting, and they're open for the public at Dr. Isengoth Rogers' home. She'll be hosting. So I'd like to thank her for your patience.
Okay. If there are no additional board reports, then we will stand adjourned.
I have to attest your signature on that.